The new book, Death is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries and the New Era of Private Warfare, is the inside story of how the Wagner Group made private military companies inextricable from Russia's anti-Western foreign strategy by independent journalist John Lechner. Lechner made his first trip to the Central African Republic in 2019, where he began researching the effect of Russian intervention on the country's armed politics. A speaker of Russian and French, among other languages, he was among the first to reconcile Russian and African perspectives on what we now call the Wagner phenomenon and parse the complex relationship between its private interests and the Kremlin's across multiple theaters. His dispatches from Africa, long before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and Wagner's global rise, drew a loyal following among journalists. Death is Our Business traces 5 years of Lechner's reporting from some of the world's most dangerous places, including the front lines in Ukraine. And it's a great pleasure to welcome John Lechner to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate having you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I assume it seems in what I just read and even from the book that this was a beat that you didn't necessarily expect you were going to get.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I had also done a number of things before becoming a writer and journalist. I was first an investment banker, but I really initially came at the topic based on my true passion, which is languages and linguistics. And I had spent a few years living in Russia before going to college, and then had spent a lot of time in Africa, and was drawn initially to the Central African Republic, really to kind of understand what happens when these people from very disparate societies, Russian and Central African, come together, and how do people adapt or don't adapt. Eventually, I think it became clear to me that what I was seeing was such an interesting phenomenon, and Wagner itself kind of increasingly rose to prominence, that it became clear that there was a book to be written about it.
So tell me where you come in this story when we talk about the origins of Wagner. Talk a little bit about those origins, and then where you come in to the story.
Sure. So Wagner initially came out of what we would now call the first phase of the war in Ukraine and in Donbas and eastern Ukraine in 2014. What was happening in eastern Ukraine at that time, well, in Ukraine more generally, you had a revolutionary environment with the Maidan Revolution, and the Kremlin and Russia reacts by annexing Crimea, and a number of people in eastern Ukraine who were against the Maidan Revolution and favored economic and political ties to Russia launched a sort of counter-revolution that put the Kremlin actually on the back foot, because Putin at that time didn't want to annex further territory in eastern Ukraine. Donbas was not the equivalent to Crimea, but he also couldn't be seen as leaving these nascent rebel hanging out to dry. And so the Kremlin sort of had to figure out a way to both support and not support these separatists in eastern Ukraine. And they turned to these shadowy forces, to contractors, mercenaries. And one of those groups was Wagner Group, which received political and financial backing from an oligarch, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and was led by the number two, a former Russian military officer, Dmitry Utkin.
When it comes to Prigozhin, how much is he the face of the Wagner Group, and how linked are the two?
You know, I think that's always one of the central questions that folks always have is, well, you know, what is this entity? Is it a private commercial company, a private military company, a PMC, or is it simply the shadowy arm of the Kremlin? And the answer is, you know, kind of frustratingly always both. The Wagner could not have expanded in the way that it did without state support. But at the same time, it probably would have never become what it was either were it not for the incredible ambition of Yevgeny Prigozhin himself. Wagner was one of several different types of structures that were employed by the Ministry of Defense in eastern Ukraine. And after the ceasefire, what was called Minsk II at the time in 2015, most of those entities sort of disappeared as people went back home to other things. But it was really Prigozhin who saw the business opportunity and the value in having a quote-unquote PMC underneath him. And it was really he who lobbied constantly and positioned himself as a salesman for Russian intervention abroad.
So here is a guy who in his youth spends almost a decade in prison for robbery and fraud. And then he's selling hot dogs on the street. And the next thing you know, he's in the restaurant business. And it's quite a rise to bring him to this point of bringing him to a nickname of Putin's chef.
Yeah, he again, it's a testament to his ambition. He, as you mentioned, was convicted of theft and assault and went away to prison for 8 years. And, you know, like in many societies, it's not necessarily unique to Russia, there is quite a stigma that comes along with being an ex-con. And I think so much of his ambition was really also a chip on his shoulder as he was trying to overcome his lower class status in Putin's Russia and rise to Putin's inner circle. He was a consummate networker. He was always looking to meet the next most important person, but he was able to leverage in a way kind of his uncouth criminal past in a way that was refreshing to Vladimir Putin as sort of this guy who would do anything for him. But those same traits also resulted in the kind of more buttoned up Russian elite and inner circle trying to shun him at all times. And so Wagner itself was in a way the byproduct of one man's ambition to eventually reach Putin's inner circle and show the value of what he can bring to the Kremlin and to Putin himself.
So talk about that for a moment of how he starts to make a name for himself and Putin becomes aware of him and his actions.
So it really came about when Prigozhin, as you mentioned, was a restaurateur in St. Petersburg in the late 90s. He owned two restaurants that very much catered to the Russian elite, serving, you know, all the things that the nouveau riche enjoy, caviar, champagne, you know, the most expensive steaks. And this is where a younger Vladimir Putin was known to dine and where he met Yevgeny Prigozhin. Prigozhin managed to leverage those contacts that he made as a restaurateur to become the contractor for providing meals to the Russian military in Russian schools. And this is where he earned that nickname, Putin Chef. And we have to understand that Russia at this time under Putin is a country that is coming out of the devastating 1990s, the economic shock therapy, country that was a superpower before that becomes almost a third world country. And Putin is incredibly ambitious about bringing the Russian state back as a strong state. But their means to do so and their capacity is still relatively limited. And so this allows for oligarchs, businessmen like Yevgeny Prigozhin, to sort of fill those budgetary gaps by sponsoring what they would consider these patriotic initiatives. And it's a form of virtue signaling in a way, right, that in the same way that businessmen will donate to a political party, they're not going to recoup those exact costs directly, but it's a, you know, think of me down the road as you're voting sort of thing. When the Kremlin needed to turn to these sort of shadowy forces in eastern Ukraine, this was an opportunity for Prigozhin to step in and show his worth by sponsoring one of these mercenary groups.
Death is Our Business is the name of the new book by John Lechner, who is our guest on the roundtable this morning. I know it's a mix, but how much of the core of what this group was doing was about the money as opposed to what you just referred to as the virtues?
Yeah, I mean, it's always both, as you said. I mean, I think, you know, we ourselves too live in a capitalist society, right? And so it's not counterintuitive that companies like Lockheed Martin, which makes jets and military equipment and bombs, you know, it's a profit-driven, publicly traded company, right? But they will always frame what they do, and the folks there, I'm sure, believe it as well, that they are also furthering America's security and national interests. And Russia is, you know, a different form, but it is a form of a capitalist state now. And so, and I've spoken to a lot of folks in Wagner, I don't think that they see it as counterintuitive that they're furthering Russia's interests and they're getting paid to do so as well. When we look, though, at sort of who the clients are, we can see where Prigozhin was operating more on his own and operating more in concert with the Russian state. And so in eastern Ukraine in 2014, and again in 2022, it's very clear that Ukraine, a country on Russia's borders, is sort of an existential national security interest to the greater Russian state. Syria, where Wagner first started intervening along with the Russian military in 2015, was also of clear national interest. And Wagner worked very closely with other security institutions of the Russian state, FSB, the Russian Ministry of Defense, Russian military intelligence. But once you get to places like the Central African Republic, there really isn't any other Russian state presence there. And in that sense, Wagner basically became the Russian state in the Central African Republic. Wagner's political technicians went out and were bringing together armed groups into a peace deal. So they were working as diplomats. They were businessmen involved in gold mining and breweries and all sorts of businesses. Part of the need to go into those various kind of economic enterprises is that the subsidies, the payment from the Russian state for those operations was in short supply. They were pretty much on their own in a way that they're not in, say, Ukraine, where they're very much paid by the Russian state to be there. And so that's why Wagner was always sort of this very interesting mix of both a public and a private partnership. And the relative weight of public versus private really depended on the context of where they were and how important that country was to the Russian state itself.
For the book, you interviewed many civilians and politicians, those inside the Ministry of Defense. And I'm curious as to what you got out of those conversations in the sense of what they saw in Wagner that made them want to partner with them.
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, we have to understand that if we take the Central African Republic, for example, this has been one of the center of all sorts of peacekeeping forces that have been there from the UN to other multinational groups. This has been a place that has suffered under French colonialism and neocolonialism for over a century now. And it's a place that has never been of great interest to other powers. The French left the Central African Republic in the middle of a civil war to basically fare, you know, on their own. The United States is not interested in sending troops. And so from the Central African perspective, where they're dealing with these very powerful armed groups, you know, who else is available to partner with? And when you're in a conflict, you don't really get a choice of the actors that you prefer. You get a choice of the actors that are available to partner with. And so these decisions are very nuanced and based on a cost-benefit analysis of whether or not the benefits of working with a PMC like Wagner Group outweigh the potential downsides.
When you look at the current state of the Wagner Group now, where does it stand at this moment?
So after Yevgeny Prigozhin's mutiny and eventual demise, there has been an effort to bring all of Wagner Group kind of subordinate to under the rule of the Ministry of Defense. And that, from a technical perspective, has largely happened. But in terms of the replacement of personnel, it's been a very mixed bag in terms of what the Ministry of Defense has been able to do. And so in Ukraine, the people who fought for Wagner, if they so prefer, they continue to fight for other units. In Syria and in Libya, the handover has been relatively easy. Folks have signed new contracts, for example, or just gone home, but it's been relatively easy to replace them. Well, until other events have taken over in Syria, but at that time. In the other areas where Wagner was operating, in the Central African Republic and in Mali, it's been a bit of a different story. In the Central African Republic, as I mentioned before, it's never been – it was important to Prigozhin. It was important to Wagner, but it wasn't important to the Russian state itself. And so these officials from the Ministry of Defense showed up, and they looked at all of these complicated businesses, breweries, gold mines, a counterinsurgency, and the kind of decision was made, well, if it's not broke, let's not try to fix it right now. And so it's been kind of left to the guys who have been there for 7 years now and understand the country. They can't just replace everyone and expect things to go on as normal. In Mali, it's been incredibly difficult because Wagner has been out in the bush, essentially fighting two different jihadist groups as well as separatists in the north in what is a incredibly complex, overlapping, essentially ethnic civil war that's masking the jihadist insurgency. And the Russians have had difficulty in figuring out how to replace, if they want to, even these guys, because resources are limited with the full war in Ukraine ongoing, but also kind of figuring out exactly what is even going on there. And so it's been very difficult for them to hand over to a new force because there's so many cooks in the kitchen between the various Malian security institutions who are also part of the planning, the Russian Ministry of Defense, Wagner commanders on the ground, and not a very clear kind of command and control at the moment. So Mali, we're still kind of waiting to see how exactly the Ministry of Defense will decide what they actually want to do in the country. Do they want to continue to have these Wagner forces that are involved in offensive operations, or do they want to scale back and focus on just training local forces instead?
The new book is Death is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries and the New Era of Private Warfare. John Lechner is the author. It is published by Bloomsbury. John, thank you very much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Death is Our Business, by John Lechner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.